So as I said yesterday, I'd like to spend the rest of this session talking about the five modes or five ranks of Tung Shan or Tozan. There are two sets of five modes or positions, and each mode has a correspondent in the other cycle. The first set are usually translated as the phenomenon and the universal. And the second cycle of five often are entitled honor and virtue. Eiken Roshi says the first cycle, that of the phenomenon and the universal, relates to the substance of Zen Buddhist practice and is closely related to the other cycle, the cycle of honor and virtue, which relates to the manner of practice. There is certainly a developmental stepping from one mode to the next, but also each mode is full and complete within itself. The 8th and 9th century in China saw many giants in the Zen Buddhist world, and Tung Shan was second to no one. This was the time of Matsu, Pei Chang, Wang Po, Lin Qi, Sui Feng, and Kui Shan, just to name a few. Zen Buddhism, or Chan, had flowered, and the fragrance permeated all styles and manners of teaching. Tung Shan, or Tozan, and one of his successors, Sao Shan or Sozan, are the beginnings of the Soto sect, which takes its name from these two. So Sozan and Tozan is Soto. So as I go on over the next few days, I'll tell you some stories about Tung Shan from the Record of Tung Shan, translated by William Powell. And I'll talk some of his days as a student, and then of his maturing years, and then his years on pilgrimage. And today I'll tell you of his death story to give a taste of this teacher. It is interesting that in many stories and dialogues with Tung Shan, there are never yells or the exchange of blows or pushes. His teaching is always extremely articulate, witty, and dynamic, and the exchanges often left the visitor or guest astonished and awed with no means of reply. So I'd like to read you one of those exchanges. When the master was in Li Tan, he met head monk Chu, who said, "How amazing! How amazing! The realm of the Buddha and the realm of the path, how unimaginable!" Accordingly, the master said, "I don't inquire about the realm of the Buddha or the realm of the path. Rather, what kind of person is he who talks thus about the realm of the Buddha and the realm of the path?" When after a time Chu had not responded, the master said, "Why don't you answer more quickly?" Chu said, "Such aggressiveness will not do. You haven't even answered what you were asked, so how can you say that such aggressiveness will not do?" said Tung Shan. Chu did not answer. Tung Shan said, "The Buddha and the path are both nothing more than names. Why don't you quote some teaching?" "What would a teaching say?" asked Chu. "When you've gotten the meaning, forget the words," said the master. "By still depending on teachings, you sicken your mind," said Chu. "But how great is the sickness of the one who talks about the realm of the Buddha and the realm of the path?" said Tung Shan. Again, Chu did not reply. The next day, he suddenly passed away. At that time, Tung Shan came to be known as one who questions head monks to death. Good thing he's not of our time. Also in his dialogues, there is rarely the finale of "and he was enlightened or awakened." And it might be that the path was more important for Tung Shan, or at least for the compilers of this record, than that actual moment of waking up. So before going on to these first few lines of the first rank, I'd like to tell you of Tung Shan's death celebration, which will give you a little more of a flavor of the teacher we're about to encounter and engage over the next several days. When Tung Shan was about to enter the perfect rest, he addressed the assembly saying, "I've had a worthless name in this world. Who will get rid of it for me?" When none of the assembly replied, a novice monk came forward and said, "Please say what the monk's Dharma name is." The master said, "My worthless name has been eradicated." A monk asked, "Although the monk is unwell, is there actually one who is not sick?" "There is," replied Tung Shan. "Will the one who is not sick treat the monk?" The master said, "I am entitled to see him." "I wonder how the monk will see him." "When I see him, there will be no perception of sickness," replied Tung Shan. The master continued by asking the monk, "After I have left this filthy, oozing shell, where will we meet?" The monk didn't reply. Tung Shan recited a gatha. "Disciples as numerous as grains of sand in the river Ganges, not one has gained enlightenment. They err in seeking it as a path taught by others. To eliminate form and eradicate its traces, make utmost effort and strive diligently to walk in nothingness." Then the master had his head shaved, bathed himself, and put on his robes. He struck the bell and announced his departure to the assembly. Sitting solemnly, he began to pass away. Immediately, the large assembly began to wail and lament. This continued for some time without stopping. The master suddenly opened his eyes and addressed the assembly, saying, "For those who have left home, a mind unattached to things is the true practice. People struggle to live and make much of death, but what's the use of lamenting?" Then he ordered a temple official to make arrangements for a delusion banquet. However, the assembly's feeling of bereavement did not go away, so preparations for the banquet were extended over 7 days. The master joined with the assembly in completing the preparations, saying, "You monks have made a great commotion over nothing. When you see me pass away this time, stop making such a noisy fuss." Accordingly, he retired to his room, sat correctly, and passed away in the third month of the 10th year. This is in the year 869. He was 63 and had spent 42 years as a monk. His shrine was then called the Stupa of Wisdom Awareness. So that gives you some sense of this teacher, Tung Shan. So the first mode of the first cycle, entitled "The Phenomena Within the Universal," goes like this. When the third watch begins, before the moon rises, don't think it strange to meet and not recognize the other, yet still somehow recall the elegance of ancient days. The third watch in Chinese horology is midnight, and the moon has not yet risen. The clouds hang low, so low that the trees and buildings, the rocks and hillsides are no longer discernible. The future does not have one, and the past is long lost and forgotten in the ever-thickening and unfolding dark. Even the present can no longer be located, lost somewhere in the starless night. Time has been torn open, and the laws of cause and effect obliterated. You have the notion that things make sense like never before, yet you cannot say of what or how. You have an inkling, a premonition. You stand on the edge, but of what you cannot say. T.S. Eliot might say it like this: garlic and sapphires in the mud clot the bedded axle tree. The trilling wire in the blood sings below inveterate scars, appeasing long forgotten wars. The dance along the artery, the circulation of the lymph are fringed in the drift of stars, actually are figured in the drift of stars. Ascend to summer in the tree, we move above the moving tree. In light upon the figured leaf, and here upon the sodden floor below, the boarhound and the boar pursue their pattern as before, but reconciled among the stars. The ocean at this midnight is unmoving, as still and calm as a mill pond. Not a wave or breath of wind arises. The gulls have left or quieted, as have the killdeer, bush tits, and shorebirds. There is only the stillness. There is only moo. There is only moo, breathing moo. You are like a fish in water or a bird in the air, completely at rest, relaxed, porous. Inside and outside are only old, useless concepts. Big or small, good or bad, leave them for another day. You are no longer yourself. How could you possibly meet and recognize the other? And in this you are no longer yourself. An interesting thing happens. Your usual defenses drop or become utterly porous. Fear, anxiety, the troubled state of affairs that we usually carry around in our bodies are settled and go to rest. And in that moment, with that clearing, the clearing of our fears and our subtle worries, we begin to find that we are not so alone. We are inhabited by bird calls. We are inhabited by waves and wind. We are inhabited by footsteps and by bell sounds. Or we can say we find that we inhabit those things. The direction and the speech at this time do not yet matter. What does matter is we are not in this by ourselves, because there is no such thing. That perspective of a self is mistaken. It is a fallacy, a fiction. We contain and are contained, but at the third watch, we still cannot point or touch. We still cannot tell. T.S. Eliot said it like this: at the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance, but neither arrest nor movement. And do not call it fixity where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline. And although you are stilled inside and out, you are not quieted. Although you are stilled, you are not complacent or passive. You are upright, poised, and pregnant with the stars and the moon, pregnant with mountains and rivers, pregnant with sapphires and garlic, and with the dark and with the light. But really, right now, we are pregnant, but we know not with what. So when the bell rings, we sit. When the clappers sound, we bow. And after we hear, I beg to urge you, everyone, life and death is a grave matter, we simply get up and go to bed, where we deepen the dream we have been living all day, during the night or blackness of daytime. This is called Sagara Mudra Samadhi, or ocean seal absorption. Aiken Roshi writes, we seal our zazen with our zazen mudra, left hand over the right, thumbs touching. Our minds are sealed with the serenity and depth of the great ocean in true zazen. This is mu, doing mu. This is the breath, breathing you. It is effortless but filled with a charged yet relaxed energy. The mystery of being simply coming forth as the mystery of being. There are no words yet. There are no feelings yet. There are no images or intuitions yet. This is Shakyamuni's mind under the Bodhi tree, before he looked up and saw the Venus star. So don't think it strange to meet and not recognize the other yet. It is not time. This is the time of stillness. This is the time of waiting. T.S. Eliot says it this way: be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not yet ready for thought. And so the darkness will be light. However, although the light of the darkness is essential, it is not yet still, because the question remains for you, who is that other? But even without the light, and only with the stillness and waiting, there is a growing sense, not yet conscious really, of the elegance of ancient days. There is something very familiar, very old, and very deep. You have entered the dream of the Buddha, and there is a beginning sense that this is your own dream too. There is a beginning sense that your seat is the Buddha's seat, that the Buddha's clothes are your clothes, but it is still unfathomable, yet still a dream. You have let go, and now the dream, finally vast and ancient, the oldest dream there is beginning to have you. Dogen says in the Fukan Zazenji, apply yourself to the way that points directly at reality. Honor the one who is beyond learning and free of rank. So again, that question remains. Who? Who is that other? This is the time to be guided by the question, what is mu? What is the other? This is the time to be guided by the question, who hears? This question is your guide and container, and it will not let you become complacent or self-absorbed. Shakyamuni Buddha looked up and saw the Venus star and then went off to find his friends. He resolved his question, and you still need to resolve yours.